From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It lasted so long, we almost lost track of it. So many years, so many dead, so many dollars. And now U.S. troops are pouring out of Iraq. What did all that mean? What does it leave behind? This hour, On Point, as it ends, we weigh the Iraq War. You can join the conversation. Was the war worth it? What have we learned in these last nearly 9 years? How do you size it up? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Two things we couldn't say when this long war began. On March 19th, 2003, President Bush announced to the country that war in Iraq had begun. The air campaign was dubbed Shock and Awe.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
Broad and concerted campaign. It would ultimately take nearly 4,500 American lives. Thousands and thousands of Iraqis would die. Many tens of thousands Americans wounded. How much did the country spend on this war? Well, you can take it anywhere from $800 billion to a trillion to $4 trillion. It depends how you want to calculate it. And the popularity of the war fell as its difficulty rose. In 2005, all the way back there, President Bush delivered a primetime address at Fort Bragg, reaffirmed his administration's commitment to the war 2 years after the war began, but voiced the question that many Americans had begun to ask.
Like most Americans, I see the images of violence and bloodshed. Every picture is horrifying, and the suffering is real. Amid all this violence, I know Americans ask the question, is the sacrifice worth it?
Yesterday, also at Fort Bragg, NPR took its microphones to some of the military people and families who paid the price for this war. Here, NPR asked 16-year Army veteran Chief Warrant Officer Joseph Grano about whether the war was worth it.
I don't think sometimes that war really has anything. Nothing could really be worth the price of war at times. So for me, that's a difficult question to answer with a yes or no.
Grano's wife, Layla, at Fort Bragg, noted right there to NPR that she was one of the lucky Army wives.
Wow, was it worth it? You know, for me it was difficult. I grew personally from it, but then again, my husband came home. You know, it's, I think to the individual it has a different meaning to each person, but I'm glad it's coming to an end, basically. That's where I stand on it.
And here yesterday, President Obama, also at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, talking about U.S. troops leaving Iraq and the view of history.
Those last American troops will move south on Desert Sands. And then they will cross the border out of Iraq with their heads held high. One of the most extraordinary chapters in the history of the American military will come to an end. Iraq's future will be in the hands of its people. America's war in Iraq will be over. Now, we knew this day would come. We've known it for some time. But still, there is something profound about the end of a war that has lasted so long.
The president yesterday, and notice the military hoo-ah there came when he said America's war in Iraq will be over. In Baghdad today, a ceremony marked the formal end to combat operations in Iraq with this music in part from the 25th Infantry Division Brass Quintet. After the nearly 9 years of the Iraq War, we are weighing that war today. Let me introduce our guest. Joining me now from Falls Church, Virginia, is Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, retired U.S. Army colonel with 31 years of service. Since leaving government, he's been critical of the planning and execution of the Iraq War. He's currently a visiting professor at the College of William and Mary, lecturer in the Honors Program at George Washington University. Lawrence Wilkerson, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
From New York, Peter Beinart, former editor of The New Republic, he supported the invasion of Iraq in 2003, later changed his mind. He's senior political writer at The Daily Beast, professor of journalism, political science at the City University of New York, author of The Good Fight and The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. Peter Beinart, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And with us from Stanford, California, is Cori Shaki, research fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor at the U.S. Military Academy. She was senior policy advisor to the 2008 McCain-Palin campaign. She was in George W. Bush's first term. When the war began, she was director for defense strategy and requirements on the National Security Council. She's author of Managing American Hegemony, Essays on Power in a Time of Dominance. Cori Shaki, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Lawrence Wilkerson, first to you. It's hard to sum up something with so much cost and so many years and so many implications, but how have you begun, as troops pull out and no doubt even before, to weigh this war, its meaning, its significance, Colonel?
Well, there's so many dimensions to it. I'm struck by the wife who said, "I'm glad it's ending." I suspect there are wives all across the country from all the services who are saying that. I was also struck by what President Obama said about Iraq's future will be in the hands of the Iraqi people. That echoes T.E. Lawrence, whom we know as Lawrence of Arabia, who said after his many trials and tribulations in the world of Arabs and others, that it is better for the country in which you're trying to state build to do things imperfectly than it is for you to do them perfectly. And I would simply add to that, with regard to America, we don't do these things perfectly at all. So I'm very happy to see it ending. I think Iraq's future is in Iraq's hands, and I think that's very well where it should be. As you noted, I have very mixed emotions about the whole process, the bad planning, the fighting in the bureaucracy that caused some of the problems in 04, 05, 06, and 07. The fact that the president himself had to personally take over the war after he fired Donald Rumsfeld, all of that it's ground I've plowed, and it's very difficult for me to talk about it and to come to any real conclusions about it because of that.
NPR asked the military families there at Fort Bragg. Let me put the same question to you. Was it worth it?
That's a difficult question to ask, and I think only history and how Iraq turns out will answer that question. And I have to caveat and qualify that heavily by saying that I don't think the way Iraq turns out eventually will have very much to do with what we did. In fact, we probably inhibited any real positive development that Iraq could feel economically, politically, security-wise, and so forth. Iraq's future is in Iraq's hands, as the president said. The greatest defense against what some of my colleagues in the Republican Party are saying a tremendous threat, Iran, is Iraqi nationalism. My son, who was in Kirkuk advising the Iraqi Third Air Force, said the one thing that unified all the people in that Air Force, Sunni, Shia, and otherwise, was their disgust with Iranians, their hatred even for Iranians. That's the nationalism within Iraq is what will protect Iraq from Iran, not U.S. troop presence.
Cori Shaki in California, you, like Lawrence Wilkerson, were there in the first Bush administration when this war began. Now here we are nearly 9 years later, and it is ending. The last troops are coming out, just a few thousand left, and most of them headed for the border into Kuwait. Was it worth it?
I think it was worth it, although I agree with Larry's concerns about the enormous price we paid to achieve it. Much of that price could have been avoided by much better management of the war by us in the Bush administration.
The numbers are so high that it's hard to say it was worth it and then look at the cost. We're talking here, you know, depending how you want to calculate it. I mean, blood, we all know the death toll, money, $1 trillion, $4 trillion. When you put the actual cost in blood and national treasure against it, is it a question mark? Can you come down one way or the other?
I understood that was what you were asking me. My answer, though, is that it's hard to reconstruct now just how threatened the United States felt by Saddam Hussein's weapons program. And remember, he was in violation of 17 UN Security Council resolutions about that program. He was working very hard to make us believe that he had a program that we felt threatened by. I was not in the administration during September 11th, but when I joined the administration not long after that, I was really struck by how frightened people were, how very much it weighed on the senior policymakers that the attacks of September 11th seemed to them to come out of the blue, and they really didn't want to have to go back to Americans after a similar experience with Saddam Hussein and say, yes, we knew this guy was a problem for more than a decade. Yes, we've had continuous military operations going on, removing his control of roughly a third of his country. Yes, he not only has chemical weapons, he not only used them on an enemy, Iran, in warfare, he used them on his own public. Yes, we could have done more, and we didn't. My experience in the Bush administration was how heavily that concern weighed on policymakers' minds in the run-up to the war.
And yet, we look back at the justifications for the war, and Lawrence Wilkerson knows this well from his work with Colin Powell. You know it well from your position right there. Peter Beinart watched it all and has written eloquently since. And we see so much that was off base, so much that was not correct in the very roots of the war. Peter Beinart, please stand by. I'm sorry, we're up against a break here, but we'll come right back to get the beginning of your view on this. Listeners, here we are, the end of the Iraq War. Almost 9 years, many dead, many questions. We're asking how you weigh this war. What's your bottom line on the war in Iraq? Behind us, U.S. military brass band playing at the formal end of combat operations in Baghdad yesterday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the end of the Iraq War. More music there from the U.S. 25th Infantry Division, Brass Quintet. You heard them play the Star Spangled Banner. Here's the transition. Now you hear them playing the Iraqi national anthem at the formal close of U.S. combat operations in Iraq yesterday. We're looking at this war and what it has meant. With Lawrence Wilkerson, he was at the side of Colin Powell when he was Secretary of State when this all began. Cory Shockey was on the National Security Council back in the first Bush administration. Peter Beinart was editor of the New Republic, supported the invasion, later turned in a big way against this war. Here's a little bit more of President Obama at Fort Bragg yesterday.
We remember the early days, the American units that streaked across the sands and skies of Iraq, the battles from Karbala to Baghdad, American troops breaking the back of a brutal dictator in less than a month. We remember the grind of the insurgency, the roadside bombs, the sniper fire, the suicide attacks, from the Triangle of Death to the fight for Ramadi, from Mosul in the north to Basra in the south. Your will proved stronger than the terror of those who tried to break it.
President Obama speaking to troops at Fort Bragg yesterday. The grind of the insurgency, the roadside bombs, the Triangle of Death. Yes, we do remember those things. Was it worth it? The president was struggling with this a little bit, but putting it in the most glorious terms he could. Here he is once more from Fort Bragg.
Now, Iraq's not a perfect place. It has many challenges ahead. But we're leaving behind a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq with a representative government that was elected by its people. We're building a new partnership between our nations. And we are ending a war, not with a final battle, but with a final march toward home. This is an extraordinary achievement, nearly 9 years in the making.
Ending the war with a final march toward home. I guess that's how wars have to end. Peter Beinart, what are you thinking as you look back on the beginnings, the terrible middle of this, and now the end?
Well, it's almost hard to really get one's head around. And I think, as Lawrence Wilkinson said, I think we should all have a certain level of humility in trying to predict how this might look 10 or 20 years down the line, particularly those of us like myself, who I think got the war wrong to begin with. But I suppose my bottom line would be, if you told Americans in 2000, in 2002 and 2003. We're going to spend this extraordinary amount of money and lose more people than we lost on 9/11. And it will turn out that Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction. I don't think it would be a close call. Now, you can say, of course, that's with 2020 hindsight. But I would say that part of the problem of the way we went into war in Iraq was there was not a cost-benefit and that sufficient cost-benefit calculation. There was an assumption that resources were plentiful. You know, remember Dick Cheney said, you know, deficits don't matter because we'd overcome the Reagan deficit so easily in the 1990s. I think if we had been wiser about some of the trade-offs that many people knew we were going to face, fiscal trade-offs, partly brought about as a result of the Bush tax cuts, partly as a result of the aging of the baby boomer population, we might have been able to have, I think, a conversation about trade-offs that today that would have made it clearer that, in fact, this was not the best use of American resources at a time in a context where we're now having to cut so deeply into things that really impact average Americans' lives.
Lawrence Wilkinson, talk with us about resources and cost-benefit analysis. I mean, can we ever get that right going into a war? You know, we could be asked again to go to war. What can we learn on that front from this one to take in forward in our backpacks, Lawrence?
I hope to God we learn something from it. I kind of agree with your intimation that we probably won't because history shows we don't. But I agree with Peter entirely. Even given what Corey said, and I lived through that, I watched the black smoke roil up from the Pentagon on 11 September 2001 from the steps of the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
The politics of fear was exploited by people like Karl Rove and others, strictly for political opportunism, in order to get things done and to obviate any need for any kind of strategic analysis, let alone a cost-benefit analysis. You have people like Paul Wolfowitz contradicting the chief of staff of the Army, who just come from the Balkans and knew what it took to police a place like Iraq. And Wolfowitz has the gall, the colossal gall. Paul must today rue his having said this. At least I hope he does, because Paul has a conscience. That it's hardly imaginable that it'll take more troops for the post-conflict situation than the actual war.
Yeah.
What an idiot. The cost-benefit analysis question really has not been addressed from the highest levels in this land since Dwight Eisenhower required every national security decision document to have an appendix that gave him the best estimate from his budget folks as to what that decision was going to cost the nation. We haven't done that since Dwight Eisenhower. That's some indication of how profligate we've become.
Corey Shockey, you were there in the room. You've described what you felt as the fear in the administration about the menace that could be there in Iraq in those days. Lawrence Wilkerson looks at that and says, okay, but there was also political exploitation of fear here that sort of a bulled past strategic analysis. Did you feel that in the moment, Corey?
I did not, although remember, I was the third rower on the left or
okay.
of the galley.
Yes.
I agree with Larry's very good point about cost estimates. I, too, get homesick for the Eisenhower administration where the head of the Treasury could veto the national security strategy because he thought it was financially unexecutable. And it's been a very long time since the United States thought about the cost effectiveness of its strategies, and we really ought to.
I mean, as Peter Beinart paints it, it goes right to the very heart of our national life at this point. You know, how could we have been so unholistic then, so blithely thinking cakewalk or Iraq oil will pay for it, when now we've got deficits so big they're the only thing a lot of people are thinking about, Corey?
Well, I quite like the argument that Peter makes in his book about imperial hubris. I think there was a lot of that in the air in the year 2000, 2002, 2003, 2005, where we did not do nearly a good enough job of being solid, cheap conservatives.
How do we keep that hubris from kicking in again the next time, Peter Beinart?
Well, I think the point about conservatives is actually really, really important. I think, in a weird way, I think the most important dog that didn't bark in the Iraq War debate was conservative opposition. I think the
neoconservative, but something else. Define it.
Well, it's the fact that neoconservatives who I think this had neoconservatives were on this roll after American success in the Gulf War and Bosnia and Kosovo, and had a vision of essentially that American power had to keep expanding further and further into the further reaches of the globe and produce this ideological transformation. That was, in many ways, a very unconservative vision, because conservatives famously, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan believed that culture matters more than politics. So the idea that conservatives believed that you could go into a country like Iraq as an external force and remake Iraqi society and turn it into some radically different place was actually a very deeply unconservative idea. And I suspect that there were many prominent conservatives in Washington who actually in their bones were highly skeptical of the idea. But I think what happened was there was a groupthink that emerged, particularly on the American right, and also, frankly, as Lawrence said, a lot of bullying of people, which led to those voices, except for Brent Scowcroft and one or two others, not really speaking out. And so I think we didn't really have the debate. The debate, if you remember, was very focused on whether we had multilateral support.
Mm-hmm.
Liberals, because they tend to focus on international legitimacy, focused a lot on whether we got UN support. But in some ways, I think the even deeper critique, which was simply just that we were not smart enough to do this. You know, people say, well, we could have managed the war better. Yes, but it's conservatives who always remind us that government tends to be dumb. We should have expected government to be dumb in the circumstance. And I think that was a hugely important part of the argument that wasn't made in those crucial months leading up to the war.
Peter, it's sort of mind-boggling now to look back at that time that Corey and Lawrence describe, and you know it well, you all paint the picture. We were all there. The Bush administration and many others seeing the United States as this tremendous, sort of unlimitless hyperpower. Now here we are with the formal end of this war, and we're talking about being a broken superpower. Did the Iraq War break us, Peter Beinart?
Well, let's hope it didn't break us, but I think it certainly put us in a much weaker position to deal with the kinds of threats that we're facing from rising economic challengers. And I think it goes back, you know, to echo the point about Eisenhower. I think that what we bought in, many people, and the Bush administration, I think, propagated this. They said this was going to be our new World War II and our new Cold War. Those were depicted as military victories, and this was going to be a military victory in the war on terror. I think what was lost was the understanding that Eisenhower had that fundamentally the reason we defeated the Nazis and overcame the Soviets was because of the strength of our economic and political system. That was our fundamental strength. The military stuff was essentially a product of that, and I think that got reversed under the Bush administration, in which our political and economic system weakened even as our military footprint expanded. And I think now we have the very difficult work of reprioritizing and remembering that what makes America strong is fundamentally the stability and dynamism of our economic and political system. And that's not doing so well right now.
Lawrence Wilkerson, was it the economics factor that left the U.S. weakened here? Was it the untruth at the origin of this war, its culture and its power that flows from economics, and it's more beyond that. We can get into morality, but where do you see the kind of weak link in this nearly decade-long effort?
All of the above, Tom. I agree with what Peter was saying, and I go back to Eisenhower again, some of the transcripts of his discussions in the National Security Council where he talks about, he uses words like, the well-being of the American people is our real national security. The fundamental economic power of this country, its belief in free markets, its ability to exploit those markets, that's the real strength of this country. And he even uses words like spiritual and cultural and social and so forth as he tries to describe to usually some disbelieving generals and admirals what real national security is. And as Peter was implying, and I would probably even go more so in saying, we've done immense damage to all these aspects of our real security. Not to leave out international reputation, prestige, which is a part of our real power in the
mm-hmm.
world, especially when it comes to human rights and things like that. We've really done damage to ourselves.
Let's go to our listeners who have listened throughout the entire duration of this war. Tyler in Rochester, New York. Thanks for calling. You're on the air, Tyler.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm all right. What do you know?
I just wanted to comment. I was in ninth grade when the Iraq War started, and I would never imagine 5 years later that I myself would be in Iraq. And I just wanted to comment from the viewpoint of somebody that has grown up throughout this time, you know, had a big impact on my teenage years and everything. And
you were ultimately there, Tyler, in the service. What service? Where?
I was in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
In Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to also comment that people with mental issues that have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, the cost from that itself, the care for veterans in the long run, is a big cost factor that people haven't been commenting about, and I think it's really something that people need to think about.
If we pick those costs up and if we do right by those people, that will be enormously costly, and there's no question about it. Tyler, I appreciate that call. Corey Shockey, I mean, there you get into the intangibles that go on as costs for years and years if we do the right thing by our veterans.
Absolutely. I agree with his judgment. I think one of the best appointments the Obama administration made was to put Rick Shinseki, the former chief of staff of the Army, in charge of Veterans Affairs. I think he's doing a terrific job.
Shinseki, who had been essentially butted off stage for his resistance to the way the war was being perceived at the outset.
Yes.
It's kind of a bitter irony that he has to come and do cleanup now. But I agree with you.
No, it's actually not a bitter irony. It's fantastic for soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines.
Would it not have been better if they did not have to suffer all the wounds that he'll now have to clean up?
Well, of course it would have been. And yet the country fights wars because we have objectives to achieve.
What was the objective here?
The objective was protecting the United States from the threats that Saddam Hussein's Iraq posed for us.
What was that threat? Where's that nuclear weapon, that weapon of mass destruction that was described?
Come on, Tom. What do you mean, come on? They were wrong on that.
Well, I mean, you were saying that it was about objectives, and that was the objective that we were taken to war on.
I agree. And the administration was wrong on that and has to bear that burden, as, of course, all of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who fought in Iraq bear that burden. But that doesn't mean that at the time that they were making the decision, many people of good faith thought they were doing the right thing.
Lawrence Wilkerson, I mean, it's hard for you to say otherwise. You were there at Colin Powell's side. He was at the UN justifying this. Do you grant good faith to everybody who took us into this?
I certainly don't, especially not to the vice president. But let me address Tyler's point, which is a superb point. I have, besides Eric, I have several friends in the Veterans Affairs Department, and I've seen some of the estimates. And I know how difficult it is going to be for them to gain from the Congress in this austere economic environment
mm-hmm.
the kind of money that's necessary to do what Tyler was saying. And I fear, especially looking back on our history, I fear that we're not going to appropriate that money. And so Tyler's concern is going to go flapping in the wind. We're not going to take care of these post-traumatic stress disorder, brain problems, all manner of new kinds of concerns that we have. We're not going to take care of them the way we should. I've heard the billions of dollars of estimates that in health care costs and so forth that are necessary, and I fear that Tyler's fears are going to come to reality.
Peter Beinart, just a few seconds before the break, but yet there's yet another cost, attended or unattended. It's a cost to Americans, to individuals, and collectively to our country.
Yeah, and I think it's also really important as we talk about this to remember that some of those soldiers from Iraq are now going to Afghanistan. American servicemen and women are being deployed today from the United States to go to Afghanistan. What have we learned from this Iraq experience that we can apply to that? Does anyone really believe that the blood and money that we're pouring into Afghanistan with Al-Qaeda virtually on its knees is a good use of our money and blood, and yet we're still spending it as we speak?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking today about the end after nearly 9 years of the Iraq War. So many dead, so many questions. We're asking how you weigh this war. Corey Shockey is with us. She was on the National Security Council as Defense and Strategy Requirements Director in George W. Bush's first term. Lawrence Wilkerson was at the elbow of Secretary of State Colin Powell, 31-year veteran colonel and a former chief of staff to the U.S. Secretary of State. Peter Beinart was editor of The New Republic. He's at the Daily Beast now, author of The Icarus Syndrome and The Good Fight. The whole spectrum of response here online. Patrick says, useless waste of time, money, human life. Greg says, Iraq went from sworn enemy to an ally in the heart of the Middle East. Amazing. Kind of a thumbs up there. Catherine says, a war started based on lies, trillions of dollars wasted, thousands of lives lost and injured. Terrible conflict, should never have been there. There's the gamut. Dan in Ames, Iowa. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree with a lot about, you know, we made some mistakes. I just want to point out that, you know, that the service people did need our support just because that's the country we are. That being said, I think we wasted a lot of money, a lot of face. I think a lot of that money could have been used to build up the American image. quite frankly, I would almost go up to the view that it would have been Saddam was a bad person, and maybe we should have did a covert thing and just took him out, you know,
and stay away from war. Maybe Dan, we've got it.
And think how we could have used all that money.
Well, there's no doubt the money could have been used in many other ways. Robert writes here online, it was a gift basket to Al-Qaeda and China. I mean, we could talk about that, but Peter Beinart says, yes, look what happened economically, globally, during the decade that we were so focused on this front. Joe writes, it was a war for our soldiers and those in combats, but it was really only an unjustified takeover country with no foundation, just chest-thumping pride. Lots of angles here. Let's go to John in Winchester, Virginia. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Let's get out of this. I served in Iraq twice, and I did Afghanistan once. I thank Lawrence for his time and service, but I will make a point for both of you. You are Monday morning quarterbacking this issue to death. We're not talking about money. We're talking about projection of strength for America. America is the only superpower left. If we do not stand up for what is right, we are wrong. We become weaker. I don't know how you missed that point.
But have we been strengthened by this long war, John? You were there. You saw it firsthand. You see what we're dealing with in this country now. Are we stronger for it?
Yes, we are. We are, because how do we not know? We can sit here and say, well, cost analysis, this for this and this, but how do we know the next attack that might have happened on March 1st, 2007? We stopped that because we were on their soil, and the fight continues on their soil. It is not on our soil.
John, I appreciate your call. Lawrence Wilkerson, speak to this perspective, please.
Well, John, and Tom, I understand John's perspective. I've talked to many soldiers, and I don't blame them for having that perspective. I would not want to admit that I dedicated years of my life to something that was fruitless. But let me just point out that there are a number of problems with what John is saying. One is that we destroyed the balance of power in the Middle East, and so we put Iran in the catbird seat, and now we're having to deal with Iran because, let's face it, in reality, what was establishing that balance of power was Baghdad on the one side and Tehran on the other side. In another sense, we did create a place where Al-Qaeda didn't even have to come to the United States. I agree with John on that. Al-Qaeda could indirectly or directly affect the deaths of 4,500 Americans in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. So this argument that George Bush used to use all the time, that we're there so they won't be here, is really sort of nonsense. I'm not trying to denigrate John's service, my son's service, or anyone else's service, but that's sort of a preposterous argument. And the bigger strategic argument as to whether we're better off in that critical part of the world or not, the verdict's still out on that. But all the data so far looks like we've caused ourselves more problems than we've created solutions. So if you want to stay a superpower, you don't want to be doing that.
Iran certainly in a stronger position. Now, Travis in Quincy, Massachusetts. Travis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to comment briefly. I was there in 05, 06, and 07, 08 with the 101st Airborne.
In the worst of it. Those were the toughest years. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, 05, 06 was brutal. We lost a few guys. But I just wanted to say, you know, after Vietnam, you know, which is in some ways comparable to Iraq, in some ways not. A culture is created, you know, in our politics and our army, you know, of non-intervention. So we have, you know, Rwanda, Srebrenica, we have Darfur, yeah. we have Somalia. And a huge reason for the intervention or limited intervention in these places is never again, you know, Vietnam. You know, then we have Iraq. And the real reasons have been empirically disproven for invasion. There's no question about that. So the subsequent reasons that come out, which have to do with, you know, Saddam's a bad person, protect the Iraqi people, we compare that to the wars and the conflicts that we have opted not to get in this country, where, you know, hundreds of thousands have died. It just doesn't hold water. The real
a lot of people died in Iraq. You know that, of course, Travis. But you know,
yes, Tom.
After the Gulf War, there were huge slaughters there.
Of course. Well, that's true, Tom, but it really does not compare, and these are just facts, with, you know, some of the aforementioned conflicts I mentioned when we talk about saving innocent life. And lastly, I just want to say the real tragedy of the war has to do with, you know, the fact that it had nothing to do with protecting America, that it had to do with, you know, geopolitical plans of the Bush administration, their ideologies, oil access, defense contractor money. And lastly, it dishonors our fallen brothers and those that were hurt should not be honest about it. You know, when my uncle said to me, "Oh, you know, he wrote me an email. I'm so proud. My nephew, you know, won a Purple Heart. I've never been more proud on this day." I said, "You know what? I didn't win it protecting our country, and I'm not proud of that." People, you know, my fellow soldiers and people in this country need to read Thomas Ricks. They need to read mm-hmm. Andrew Bacevich. They need to read Paul Atwood. They need to educate themselves, and they need to stop, you know, linking, you know, patriotism and support for the military with support for this war. Which, you know, the verdict's out, Tom. History's not, you know, not old by this point. It's still young, but the
sure
verdict
isn't.
Is out.
The formal ceremony's there today. Travis with the Army Airborne in Iraq. That's a tough way to feel, coming home with the Purple Heart and feeling that way. But I appreciate your call. Peter Beinart, I know we've just got you for a few more minutes here. Step back and give us the benefit of what else you've learned here, Peter, about how we go in, how and when we get out, about our military, the size of it, the role that may or may not play in the decisions we make. Help us, Peter.
I think the relationship between the military and American society has become deeply distorted. First of all, we're simply, I think, spending much too much money on the American military compared to so many other things. You know, it's funny. I think in a way, our military is so incredible. The people like Tyler, who just called, the people who our soldiers are so impressive that in some ways they've become, that's the way in which we Americans have came to feel proud, because they were so great. America's sense of national identity used to be based around other things. You know, how the quality of our educational system, our capacity for invention. I feel like our whole self-image became distorted, in which we became reliant essentially on the military as the one can-do entity in American society. And I think part of the rebalancing that has to take place is not only a reduction in what we're asking our military to do and a reduction in the amount we're spending on new weapon systems, but also us stop outsourcing this sense of patriotism and discipline and self-sacrifice to this relatively small, extraordinary group of people who pay this enormous price, and other Americans start taking responsibilities for those kind of attributes. I think this is all part of the kind of cultural distortion that has taken place since the end of the all-volunteer military.
Share the
burden.
I think
that's a brilliant point.
Mm. Corey, yeah, please.
I think that's a brilliant point that he makes, and I really share it, that we shouldn't allow the American military, as magnificent as they are, to essentially be the proxies for things the rest of us need to be doing. One of the things that is, for me, one of the most powerful lessons coming out of the Iraq War is that a whole swath of government activity that is inherently civilian shifted into military, has shifted in both Iraq and Afghanistan into military channels, because our diplomats don't have that kind of resiliency and can-do attitude. And it's not because the good people of the Foreign Service aren't trying. It's because the institution isn't set up to make the most of them. It doesn't educate them. All the things that our military does well, we actually need to do well in other parts of American society.
And, of course, that ties back to where we pour our resources, and we've poured them into the military. Peter Beinart, I know we have to let you go. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Beinart, author of The Good Fight and The Icarus Syndrome, writer for The Daily Beast. Let's go to Buffalo, New York, and Gail. Gail, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
Good. Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to be real quick because everybody has said so much and said it so well. For me, I just feel like it's absolutely offensive, the amounts of money that have been spent on the American military. I appreciate what they do. I definitely appreciate the men and women that volunteer for it and respect those who honored the draft. But I just feel it's abominable, the loss of life that we saw in Iraq. It was so unnecessary, and particularly so many young people died and are coming back wounded, and it's just so unfair. And I really, really resent those people in Washington who lobby on behalf for defense contracts and those mega companies and firms, military firms that make money off of war, and those people that went in and put in pipelines to steal Iraq resources. This war, for me and for a lot of people in America, was about money, and it's a shame that American lives are not worth more than money.
Gail, I appreciate your call. Cost in blood and treasure, you point to. Follow the money there. One more right here. Harry in Burlington, Vermont. Harry, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Mm-hmm. I just wanted, it's more of a comment. I'm a cover artist for The New Yorker magazine, and I remember very clearly that the cover that I had done when this went down in 2003, on the eve, I think, when it was decided that we were going to war with Iraq. Normally when you do a New Yorker cover as an artist, you're elated. You're excited for that cover to come out. But, you know, I remember that getting the call from my editor, and we both just, you know, she told me that, you know, we're going to run the cover. And the image was based on an incident that happened at the UN wherein Colin Powell was making a speech, sort of an argument to go to war with Iraq, and there was a large tapestry at the UN of Picasso's Guernica, which is, as you know, an anti-war painting.
Of course.
And they sort of ordered this tapestry to be covered up. While he was making a case for America to go to war with Iraq. And my image was sort of based on that. But it was just such a tough feeling as an artist, you know, that day, that night, I should say, knowing that cover was actually going to run, because we all knew that, you know, we were going to war.
You've got the cover, we're going to war, and yet it just didn't feel good. It didn't feel right. Harry, thanks for your call. Lawrence Wilkerson, Where does this go? Where does this country take this long experience, so long that sometimes I fear that the lessons we might learn from it sort of filter away as it went on and on and on, and people began to get distracted, people thinking less about Iraq in the last year or two by far than they did 5 years ago. You know, what should we carry front of mind as we look on out at the rest of the world now, as we've got people now looking across the border at Iran and sort of pointing American power there?
Well, let me stretch the point that Corey was making and your caller, I believe Gail from Buffalo and others implied. The military has, because of its can-do attitude and its intelligent officer corps, its very educated officer corps and so forth, has been the instrument to which the president turns. This latest manifestation of that domestically, where we might destroy posse comitatus, in accordance with the amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act.
And this is in the defense budget and lets the military take care of terrorists, on you know, whether or not the U.S. citizens just take it right out of the U.S. justice system.
Precisely. I mean, this is crazy. And I can tell you, my colleagues in the Pentagon and elsewhere in the military, they don't want anything to do with this. And yet we live in a society where the civil-military relationship puts the former on top, rightfully so. So the military is going to do what it has to do, what it's ordered to do. And in that regard, I'm very concerned about this neoconservative march that's happening right now that looks like they've pulled out the same script to take us to war with Iran, further complicated by the fact that we have an ally in Western Asia, Israel, a democracy that we feel close to, that the Congress feels close to, the President feels close to, all Americans feel close to, that might take us there on its own. We seem to learn nothing, Tom. And this is very disturbing because, as Eisenhower said in his farewell address, we talked about the military-industrial complex and so forth, and he gave us a very prescient warning about that power and so forth. But what he said, too, was the only thing that can prevent this republic from going astray is an alert and knowledgeable citizenry. Well, I ask the question to all your listeners and to everyone in this country, where is that alert and knowledgeable citizenry?
Well, we're trying to build it right here every single day. We're trying, Corey Shockey, as we look ahead. As we look right across the border at Iran, you've heard what's been said on the campaign trail already about Iran. How do you think that our experience in Iraq may or should shape our thinking about Iran right now?
I do think the costs of the Iraq War have made it very unlikely that an American government would choose to address threats like what we felt from Iraq and we are currently worried about in Iran in anywhere near the same way we did in Iraq. And I think that's healthy for the Republic. I think it's a good thing that people are pausing and saying, surely there has to be a better way to do this. There has to be a less costly way to do this. We need more creativity to manage these problems. We need more non-military assets put into the mix. The Iranian government, it is for me important to remember that the so-called Arab Spring actually begins with the Persian Spring, which is the people of Iran outraged that their government had stolen an election. That actually gives the United States a lot to work with in American foreign policy. And there are lots of ways to manage this. I think the administration has gone too far in trying to suggest that there are no military options, because it does look to me that one of the few things this Iranian government responds to is fear. But that said, there are a lot of things we can do, and we need to really open up wide the aperture of thinking about how do we try and change the calculus of this Iranian government? How do we force them into a debate with their own public about their priorities?
Lawrence Wilkerson, we just got half a minute. Is fear still the tool we want to be using here? Maybe it is, but there was so much fear, as Corey herself pointed out, at the beginning of the Iraq War. Is that still the thing we lean on?
Well, here's the deal with Iran. It's pretty simple. You don't take any option off the table, which means the military's still there. Iran is going to get a nuclear weapon. We say that's unacceptable. Where does that lead you?
That's the point at which we'd all better contemplate and we'd all better learn. I'm very grateful to the two of you and Peter Beinhardt for being with us this hour. Lawrence Wilkerson was Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, 31-year Army veteran. Colonel, then, Lawrence Wilkerson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Corey Shockey at the Hoover Institution Research Fellow there was on the National Security Council in George W. Bush's first term. Ms. Shockey, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.